Migraine affects 1 in 10 children, impacting not just their physical health, but their education, their friendships, and their emotional well-being. For kids and their parents, navigating diagnosis, treatment, and support can be overwhelming. Today, we are joined by Dr. Christina Spurka, director of the Pediatric Headache Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's a leading clinician and researcher dedicated to improving care for young people with headache disorders. Dr. Spurka will share the latest on effective treatments, lifestyle strategies, and how to support kids and teens living with migraine. Dr. Spurka, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Well, I'd love to dive into a comprehensive review of pediatric migraine, including acute treatment, prevention, and support. But to start, to really talk about really the landscape of pediatric migraine, we know that migraine can be quite different from person to person, and perhaps even more so in children and adolescents versus adults. How might it present differently in youth versus adulthood?
As you said, you know, migraine affects about 1 in 10 children. That ranges from children who have low frequency headaches and essentially have a headache once a month or maybe even less, to children who have very, very frequent headache. And so about 1 or 2 out of every 10 children walking around high school, teens walking around high school, have chronic migraine, and many of those have headache that's actually continuous. And so we see really a full spectrum of migraine frequency in children, unfortunately. And we also see some variability in terms of how that might express itself. So particularly in younger children, migraine may look a little different. Sometimes the GI symptoms are more prominent. Oftentimes the pain will come up very, very quickly, and then they'll vomit, and maybe then they'll feel better. So sometimes that may evolve. Also, children may present rather with things like cyclic vomiting, episodic torticollis. So different essentially manifestations can come out. Dr. Gelfand's work even essentially looking at things like colic. And so are those early presentations of something that's going to ultimately develop into migraine? So there's those early life manifestations, and then essentially as children are in school age, they sometimes will have what otherwise appear to be relatively typical migraine attacks, but they are often briefer. Sometimes, for example, the pain may be bilateral as opposed to typically being on one side in adults. And so they look a little different, but more typical of migraine. And then as the children get older, essentially it becomes more and more typical of an adult pattern. Another thing we've actually then looked at, we have a large database at CHOP of children who have seen us for a new patient visit for migraine, or for headache in general. And we also see that as they get into adolescence, we see more and more things that are not your typical standard diagnostic features, but things like dizziness that we hear so often from patients, right? Brain fog, trouble thinking, all of those things essentially become much more common as they present essentially into the teenage years.
Interesting. So in very young children, migraine may not look at all like we're used to thinking of migraine in adults, perhaps GI symptom focused, et cetera. As they age, it might get a little bit more typical looking, but with some different features, bilateral versus one-sidedness of pain, and then evolution of some of those other symptoms like dizziness and vertigo.
Exactly. Yeah.
How underdiagnosed is migraine in children and adolescents? And what are some of the biggest challenges in getting an accurate and timely diagnosis?
So there are some pieces we know, and there are many pieces we don't know. And this is actually a large area of interest to me because, I think from a population level, we need to improve diagnosis in order to help children, right? I mean, we have very effective therapies, but we need to get them to those children. So most of the care that is delivered to children with migraine is done at the level of the pediatrician. We've done a lot of work with our primary care group here at CHOP, and many others have in other places as well. Thankfully, the pediatricians in our network have been very willing to learn more, to try to work on this. We've actually partnered in terms of building in specific EHR tools to try to help them with diagnosis, things like that. So we very much appreciate their willingness, and kudos to a pediatrician to try to manage everything, right? But it's, I think that still assumes that the child gets in the door of the doctor, right? Or the nurse practitioner. So it's, there are many, many children who don't even seek care. The statistic is, if you think about children with chronic migraine, it's, essentially probably less than half have seen a clinician within the preceding year. So that's kids with chronic migraine, right? Then we think about episodic migraine. People don't even necessarily know that it's migraine. I mean, I have many, many times had someone sit in front of me and say, that's migraine. I didn't think kids could have migraine, right? So they have to come to attention in order to get a diagnosis. And then, of course, the clinician has to be comfortable making a diagnosis. That's another major thing that we see is that, for example, many people actually present to the emergency department for the first time because there's a lot of fear about a child having a headache. Oh, my goodness, is this a brain tumor, right? So they might say, I have to get my kid to the ER. I'm really worried. And sometimes in the ER, they are seeing a child once and they don't have that relationship continuity. And so they may say, I'm not sure, right? This is one single attack. Can I make the diagnosis of migraine or not? So in some ways, that's a missed opportunity. So again, we've partnered with our emergency department to try to encourage diagnosis of migraine because then essentially it gives it a name, right? And then all of the resources that are available essentially are then more easily accessed by the family. And then we, of course, then encourage follow-up with primary care to then say, you know, let's think about treatments and things like that.
So underdiagnosis is clearly a problem. We don't know how much of one exactly, and work could be done to help better understand that. And then some of the barriers include it first rising to the level of attention of caregivers for being what it is, who may be unfamiliar with this, then getting in the door to a provider, the provider having the tools to recognize and diagnose it as such, and then that possible gap if they're seen emergently and potentially at risk of not receiving continuity of care to take the next steps. Interesting.
Exactly.
So to that first point, what should parents look for and what information should they gather in exploring this at the beginning?
Absolutely. So I think when we are evaluating a child who is presenting with headache, and I'm assuming this is headache, right? I'm essentially, as we talked about earlier, for younger children, they may actually present with belly pain. They may present with recurrent episodes of vomiting without other signs of infection, right? So take what I'm saying about headache and apply it most too, right? But so the pattern to me is really the most crucial part, because if there's a child who has an attack and then it resolves and then some time passes and then they have an attack and it resolves, I am much less worried about other causes. I think that is much, much more likely to be consistent with migraine. Of course, not everybody reads the textbook, right? And so things aren't necessarily always that clean. And we absolutely see kids who will present with a headache that doesn't go away or maybe triggered by things. We see lots of kids who have a migraineous headache after concussion. But that pattern piece is very important. And then understanding, how does it present, right? So what are the symptoms? What's the pattern of the symptoms in terms of what comes first and second and third? You know, is it just pain in isolation? Are there other symptoms that are occurring as well? Sometimes the parents can be the best, the caregivers can be the best one to really observe, right? So the child may not report the light's bothering me, but they suddenly want the lights turned down. They yell at their siblings for being noisy, right? So those things can be certainly observed in children as well.
So caregivers can be on the lookout for these recurrent episodes, recurrent attacks, typically that resolve in between, except in those more limited instances where it's onset that continues, and look for and maybe ask about symptoms that a child may not know to share, sensitivity to light or sound or nausea or dizziness, and record those symptoms so that they have some of that information about patterns and symptoms to bring to their provider.
Correct. Yes, exactly. And to be honest, as we're describing this, I don't always recommend that families keep diaries once they're sort of at the point of diagnosis and things like that, because we don't always want to draw too much attention to it. But in the very beginning, when we're trying to understand what's going on and trying to get to a point of diagnosis, it is very helpful.
Great point. Thank you. So after a diagnosis, the immediate goal is often identifying ways to effectively, acutely treat attacks when they occur. Why is early and effective treatment for each migraine attack important?
There are hints that we see that essentially if we are appropriately treating the acute attacks, that it actually may change the trajectory over time. And so when we are making that diagnosis and giving our initial counseling, we are recommending a number of different pieces. But when we speak about the treatment of the acute attack, I think so often families are concerned about giving children medication. And so they feel like, well, I should wait till it's really bad, or I should wait until, like, you know, they can't stand it anymore. And our recommendation is instead, please actually treat it early, right? As soon as the pain is spiking up, we want you to use the acute treatments, and I'm saying medication, but actually there's non-medication options as well, which we'll talk about. But get into that right immediately, because then it helps to resolve that attack more quickly. And that actually sometimes then will shorten the attack, right? So as opposed to an attack maybe lasting 2 days because it was treated very late, if it's treated early, perhaps it'll go away in an hour or two. And then essentially, right, then that's less time that the child is disabled by the migraine.
And this is a big learning curve often for a lot of us that we don't embrace until adulthood sometimes, this understanding that we're actually doing better for ourselves and maybe really for keeping our migraine under better control by treating early. So I can only imagine the learning curve. And that's why I think it's so important for parents and caregivers to be able to hear that if they're new to migraine and managing it and helping support that in their child.
Yes. And another piece with that is that the child has to be able and willing to advocate for themselves in the school setting. Because, right, if a child develops migraine in school, most of the time they are then going to be required to go to the nurse's office to get medication. And so often what I hear is, but I don't want to raise my hand. I don't want to be different. I don't want to call myself out, right? And so figuring out a way to, one, empower that child to speak up and advocate for themselves, or to come up with a way to make it less obvious, right? Perhaps it's, you know, I've talk to kids about, you know, well, can you carry a post-it and put a post-it on the corner in your desk? And that's when the teacher knows that you're going to the nurse's office or going to the restroom, but, you know, things like that. That are there ways to make it, you know, subtle, more subtle communication so that the child doesn't feel that they're called out so much? But, you know, again, ways to get them to be able to receive their treatment early.
What a wonderful insight. And I'd love to come back a little bit later too, to dig in a bit more into managing education and needs and accommodations with great suggestions like that.
Absolutely.
Can you walk us through the first line treatments that you recommend to treat a migraine attack in a child or teen as it's happening?
Absolutely. So this is an area where I would tell you that our official guidelines and our real practice don't always align. So the official guideline recommendations are to use either ibuprofen or acetaminophen as a first line, essentially. Depends on which guideline you read, but generally speaking, essentially ibuprofen has, you know, overall the best level of evidence. And for many children, that's effective, but it isn't for all. And so in the United States, rizatriptan is FDA approved. It's a triptan medication, right? Migraine specific acute medication. It's FDA approved down to the age of 6. However, the level of evidence in the studies wasn't actually strong enough to make it into the guidelines all the way down to age 6. And so actually the guideline recommendation is to use a triptan for teenagers. But what happens in real life is we see a child, we essentially try ibuprofen, perhaps we'll try something like naproxen, right? We may try combinations, but there's really, you know, given the safety information we have for something like rizatriptan, there's no reason not to reach for that, right? And so we absolutely do use triptans in children, certainly down to the age of 6, and quite frankly, I've certainly used them younger. And so it's that combination, sort of, I said that tug between what's the official evidence and then what's, you know, what's real life, right? So official evidence is use an NSAID, perhaps acetaminophen, and then, you know, if that's not sufficient, you can add something for nausea or vomiting. You could add essentially a triptan. I said, but we kind of, you know, the more that a child has not had success using certain medications, the more willing we're going to be to spread a little bit, right? And so, for example, though the GPAMP medications are still in clinical trials, we will also use those off-label, particularly in older teenagers, right? So again, so much of what we can do is limited by insurance. But in a child who has, for example, not had success with at least 3 different triptans, perhaps we might apply to the insurance company to give us a GPANT in a 15 or 16 year old. And because we feel like, you know, biologically, are they really that different from an 18 year old? No, right? And so is it reasonable for us to go ahead and use that off-label medication if we need to? We will also think about all the other non-medicine things we can do, right? Essentially thinking about how can we consider what might be bringing on that attack, and are there things we can think about, you know, to tried to manage that, right? So is it that they need access to a water bottle because they're really dehydrated by the, 11 a.m. in the school day, and they need to get access to water so that they're not dehydrated by that point, right? Is there some stressor that they're trying to manage? And then we also sometimes will use acute devices. And so there are a number of devices, which I think we'll probably circle back to later. But so we certainly will absolutely use sometimes devices, either in place of or in combination with medication.
Very interesting. So it sounds like you will often start with the guideline recommended approach of ibuprofen, maybe acetaminophen, then move on to a triptan, particularly rizatriptan in the youngest of patients, yep, given the data there, and perhaps other triptans for other ages. And yes, then you may even consider a CGRP targeted therapy, specifically the GPANTS, in those kind of mid or older teenagers, potentially all for acute treatment to help stop an attack in progress. From there, you also kind of look holistically at all of the factors that may be part of why attacks are happening beyond the biology and the genetic predisposure of this condition that somebody has, right? And see which of those can be managed to help. And then, of course, move on to also consider maybe even with medications, something like neuromodulation, which we'll dive into a little bit too.
Correct.
Now, how do you decide when to take that step beyond ibuprofen and acetaminophen? Is there a certain number of attacks that haven't been well handled by an NSAID that would lead you to take that next step to a triptan?
Yes. And so, and I think to some degree, this is a little bit of style, right? And so at this point, given when I see children, I am actually inclined to, for example, at the first visit, give them essentially steps of, I'm going to say essentially, right, first use this, but then I want you to have a triptan as a backup, right? Because I see so many kids who end up in the emergency department. I'm thinking, I don't want you to end up in the emergency department, right? A general pediatrician who's seeing the child for the first time may not take that second step yet. They may essentially say, I'm going to start with the NSAID, but they have such close contact with the family that perhaps then they'll move on. So I think some of that's a little bit of style, but, if there is an individual attack that's insufficiently treated, or if there have been a number of attacks that are just seeming to last longer than they really need to, then I will absolutely escalate to a triptan.
And what can you tell caregivers who may be experiencing their first foray into a prescription with their child about what concerns they may have about safety when it comes to using something like a triptan when that is warranted to help support their child?
Absolutely. I mean, so we've been using triptans now for 25 plus years, right? And so I do feel very comfortable using, for example, rizatriptan because of the fact that it's been, FDA labeled for so many years for such a young age. And so we've got cumulatively a lot of evidence to say it's safe. Nothing is without side effects, right? I mean, everything has potential for side effects. And so there absolutely are children who are going to have side effects to it. But they are by and large not dangerous side effects. And so we absolutely, I find that it's best to be transparent. Honestly, depending on, I think it's also important not to oversell the side effects, right? Because sometimes essentially if we talk about the side effects too much, then we make people nervous, right? And then that just makes it worse. But, being transparent about those, the potential for side effects, but then also reassuring of, there are other options. If this doesn't work for you, right, there's other things we can try. And for the vast majority of patients, we are able to find something that does work for them that doesn't cause unbearable side effects.
And I can imagine there really is a balance there between having people be informed about side effects, but not so scared about them that they're looking for them in advance. I remember
completely.
The first time decades ago that I first used a triptan and being aware of the fact that there could be what I experienced, which were some prickles and some feeling of chest tightness, and it helped me understand that that was okay because it was such a new experience for me. I could have found it very alarming, potentially even risky or dangerous, and knowing that it was anticipated helped me understand, well, maybe not my favorite feeling, it was safe.
Correct. I would say that, yes, chest tightness is theoretically possible. We see, I would say, even more commonly is jaw tightness. And exactly, to be told, okay, this is something that can happen and it will pass. And it's not pleasant, and I wish it didn't, but it will pass. And the other thing that I think about that scares families in terms of triptans is if the child's also on, for example, an SSRI, and then sometimes at the pharmacy, they'll go to pick up the medication and be told there's a black box warning, you can't use these together. And so I do my best to remember to say, to warn them ahead of, you know, yes, there, you know, there is this black box warning. I wish it weren't there. You know, the American Headache Society many years ago put out a position statement saying we're not worried about this because, you know, serotonin syndrome, which is the concern, we think is affected by a different serotonin receptor than the one that is effective with triptans. So even though there is this black box warning, I'm not actually worried about it. And so, but again, if they've heard that from us before they go to the pharmacy, they're much less worried. Whereas if they hear it for the first time from the pharmacist, then honestly, it looks like, well, that they know what they were doing, right? And so essentially, you know, is it trying to build in that just information, right? And, you know, then people, you know, I think in general, we approach our relationships with families and with children as trying to just be a dialogue, right? And essentially to make decisions together as much as we can. Because if people have information, then they're empowered and they can feel much more comfortable with things.
Absolutely. You've researched migraine-associated symptoms like photophobia. How does understanding these symptoms that may be present for a child with their migraine influence your acute treatment recommendations?
I would say that the associated symptoms, I think of as part of the migraine package. And so when we're talking about when to use acute treatments, generally speaking, I will tell them essentially at the first warning that you have a migraine, I want you to start thinking about treatment. Because again, some of it is, it's rare that our kids are carrying their own medications, right? They're going to have to go ask for it. They're going to have to essentially wait for the end of math class and go. So I don't want them to wait, right? If it is a child with aura, if it is a child who essentially their first symptom is thirst or, you know, hunger or whatever, you know, it's fine. If there's something you think you can do to manage it in a non-medicine way, right? The first thing you feel is hungry, maybe you missed breakfast that morning. Maybe the hunger is part of your migraine, right? But if you want to address that and see if it helps it, fine. But if otherwise, I want you to start thinking about getting to your medication early.
Knowing that we have a better chance of taming that attack by treating exactly. early rather than yep. waiting. Great.
Yep.
So let's now move on to talk about prevention, because once families have an acute plan in place, the next question is often, okay, how can we prevent as many attacks from happening as possible? So let's start, if we can, with non-pharmacologic options. What approaches exist, and when do you consider them for children and adolescents?
So we think about non-pharmacologic options for prevention, honestly, all the time. So even in children who have relatively low frequency of attacks, we are always trying to think about, are there things that we can do to essentially balance reducing the risk of migraine, but also balancing real life. And so I think it's really important to think about, for example, you know, the migraine brain likes consistency, to think about, you know, consistency of sleep. And so perhaps, you know, your brain just doesn't like it if you sleep until noon on Saturday, and you really need to balance it and get a little more sleep every day of the week and get up a relatively similar time on the weekdays and the weekends, right? But I don't want you to never have a sleepover if you want to have a sleepover with your friends, right? And so you've got to be a kid too. You know, I don't want your migraine driving your whole life, but I also, when it's reasonable to keep that into account and try to have a relatively consistent pattern of you know, taking care of yourself, I want you to do that. I said, but that again is where it's important to dialogue and to really have a good relationship with both parent and child, because different times, different families, essentially, you know, sometimes the child is so afraid of having the migraine that they won't let themselves go. And sometimes the families are worried. And so making sure that essentially you kind of give everybody permission to have their opinions and speak it out loud. But so we do those things, you know, taking care of yourself, things like thinking about what the water you're drinking and the exercise you're getting in everybody. When the CHAMP study came out a decade ago, and we found that essentially 2/3 of children got better in every group, we thought about, well, what else are we doing, right? And so there was the pill taking and the placebo and all of those things. But at the same time, everyone was being counseled on how to take care of themselves. Everyone was being counseled on how to use an appropriate acute treatment early. And so essentially we think that it's the combination of these things that probably has a large benefit in preventing migraine attacks. So taking good care of yourself and taking acute medications early, as we just discussed, is probably a large part of how to really prevent migraine attacks. So that's sort of where we start. And then The other thing I would think of in terms of other holistic things is sometimes our first line of preventive pill-based therapies is actually vitamins. And so we typically will make the decision to start a daily pill-based therapy when a child reports either at least one headache a week or significant disability. Sometimes if they have even less frequent attacks, but you know they last a very long time or they're really disruptive, we'll even pull the trigger a little earlier. But otherwise, I would say typically it's around the threshold of about once a week. And some would say, well, but it's a vitamin, why not do it everybody? But I also feel like you don't want to draw more attention to migraine than you need to. So in somebody who has very infrequent attacks, I don't necessarily want them taking something every day and thinking about it. But if we are moving on to vitamins, there are a number of different things that have been studied. So we've had studies on riboflavin and magnesium and, you know, many other things. How much of it is what's in the pill and how much of it is the pill taking behavior and the expectation that you're going to get better? We don't really know. Right. Again, the CHAMP study that it was amitriptyline, topiramate, placebo, and all three groups got better. We don't know what that placebo, right? Was that pill taking? Again, the other things we talked about. But so I'm not sure when I'm recommending a vitamin, if it's the vitamin itself or if it is the process of saying I'm taking something every day to get myself better and I'm going to get myself better. Maybe that's really a lot of it. But it's helpful to know that we can use relatively benign things and that really is going to help most of the time.
Interesting. So when you're thinking about prevention in children and adolescents, which you're thinking about from the beginning, even as you're talking about acute care, it sounds like you're really focusing primarily on those lifestyle adjustments that are so critical and empowering to helping to maybe reduce and best manage migraine. So consistency that the migraine brain likes around Yep. things like sleep and eating and hydration and probably movement and so forth, right? And then maybe also considering at the threshold of one attack per week or maybe less frequent, but if they're particularly disabling or long, that idea of those vitamins and supplementation, regardless of what the efficacy from that is, right?
Right. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. One thing I should actually add, though, before we move on is when we're thinking about those healthy habits, as we call them, again, it's also really important to make sure you understand, right? So if I lecture somebody and say, you need to get more sleep, but I don't ask them what's going on in their life, right? Perhaps they've got a job that's keeping them out until 11 o'clock at night and they need that job, right? So it doesn't do any good for me to lecture them on you need more sleep if that's not something that's possible in their life, right? The last thing I want to do is make a parent feel guilty because they come home late from work because that's the shift that they work. And, you know, that doesn't do any good, right? That's going to alienate them and make them feel worse. And that's not helpful. They're trying to do their best for their child. And so making sure we understand the circumstances and then try to essentially counsel, but not be, you know, not be paternalistic and you know, essentially negative in that.
Wonderful point. In what circumstances, when you're thinking about prevention, would pharmacologic options come into play?
So I think that answer will depend on who you ask right now. I would say that most of us, I think, at this point, first reach for supplements before we reach for prescription medications. However, there's a little bit of difference in terms of obviously the family's perspective, right? So there are some families who really feel strongly that they want to go to a prescription medication first, and that's an option. And then there are those of us who also might make a different decision depending on, for example, the headache frequency. I would tell you that my bias was that if I met a child who had a continuous headache, I was thinking I probably needed to go to prescription medications first rather than go with a supplement because I felt like maybe I don't need just that, you know, pill-taking behavior and those things, but maybe I really need what's in that med to actually make a difference. Interestingly, we are in the process actually we've just recently been showing at conferences and writing up a study of new daily persistent headache. So that time when essentially a headache starts and is continuous then. And by and large, unfortunately, those headaches are a little bit more difficult to treat. They don't respond as well to typical therapies. And my bias, as I said, right, was that I needed to use prescription medications. But when we looked back and did a chart review, we had 172 kids who had with NDPH. The rate of response to prescriptions and to oral prescriptions and supplements was actually very similar. And so, to be honest, it wasn't great. It was about a third in that circumstance. So not nearly as good as our responses in migraine, but still, wasn't necessarily different. So it really made me rethink my practice in terms of, you know, hey, maybe it's reasonable to say, let's start with a vitamin. Now, I will certainly escalate them essentially and keep going with additional therapies pretty quickly if that child has continuous headache, significant disability. But I think it's reasonable is to think about vitamins first and then potentially then to move on to oral prescription medications.
One of our community members named Nat asked, for adolescent girls experiencing menstrual migraine, what are the pros and cons of using birth control as part of prevention at a young age?
Absolutely. So, I mean, there are pros and cons of using birth control overall, right? And so I would say that my approach to thinking about menstrual migraine is to first think about, could we do perimenstrual prophylaxis, right? So if an adolescent girl has regular periods and they know when their period is coming, could we use something like a long-acting NSAID, a long-acting triptan? Sometimes I've even used vitamin E for a few days before and then the duration of menses. So can we do something like that to make it so that even before the headache starts, we can try to treat it? The problem is, of course, not all adolescent girls have a regular period, right? And so in that time, it is completely normal for it to take a couple of years for children to reach the point of having a regular pattern. Then we're left with sometimes the first thing they get before they get the bleeding is a headache, right? And so they get a really bad headache that then lasts for 4 or 5 days and is really hard to treat. And so we will, again, think about, can we do additional acute treatments? But it absolutely is certainly one of the things we can think about would be to use birth control. I don't personally prescribe birth control. So in this circumstance, I'm referring to either an adolescent doctor or their general pediatrician. But I think it is certainly a reasonable option to consider. And oftentimes what we'll do is we'll use, if the child really does have significant migraine around their period, we'll use a low-dose continuous medication for several months in a row to actually avoid and decrease the frequency of the period. The other piece that comes into play with this is whether there's a concern about migraine with aura. Essentially, in the setting of migraine with aura, we think about the fact that there may be a slight increased risk of stroke. And then if we're adding an estrogen-containing birth control pill, then essentially that also potentially could be additive and increased risk of stroke. This is obviously, thankfully, not something we really see very often in teenagers, right? This is a relatively theoretical risk for our patients, but it is a theoretical risk on a population level. And so in that circumstance, we will also think about, is it appropriate to start with a progesterone-containing medication, progesterone-containing pill first? Right, either something like a mini pill or things like Depo, Nexplanon. And actually, I've had many teenagers nowadays get IUDs because then it's essentially locally delivered hormone that's not systemically delivered and doesn't carry the same risks. So I would say that all of the things you might think about in a 20-year-old, we absolutely do think about in a teenage girl as well.
You mentioned earlier the possibility of the use of GPANS, a CGRP-targeted therapy, in the context of acute treatment, treating an attack when it happens. And we're starting to see CGRP-targeted medications move into pediatric care. One, fremanezumab or Ajovy, is now FDA-approved for children 6 to 17 who weigh at least 45 kilograms. What does that mean for real-world care in prevention and use of these CGRP monoclonal antibodies?
So I would say, one, I think the entire community was thrilled to pieces and we were all, you know, very, very happy to see this. How it's going to play out, I think, is a little bit of a to be determined. So where does fremanezumab fit in our cascade of treatments, right? So I personally would say I'm still going to use a vitamin first, right? But if I'm then needing to get to a prescription medication, I'm just very transparent with families and say, you know, here's what I have, right? So fremanezumab looks great in the short term. It's been around for 7 years. And so we have 7 years of long-term data, right? I don't have 40 years of long-term data like I do with some of the other medications I'm using. And so it's the devil you know, the devil you don't know, right? I said fremanezumab looks great and has fewer side effects. And some families, particularly families where one of the parents has used either that or another medication in that class, they are often very eager to move forward with that. Plus, of course, it has the advantages of things like a monthly injection as opposed to a daily pill and all of those. However, many kids don't want a shot either. And so there are definitely are circumstances where they're not interested in taking a an injection, and they'd rather stick with something that's oral in the beginning. The major other piece of this is insurance. And so even though it was FDA approved in August, we absolutely are still getting denials. And it is unclear if we're going to be able to go to Fremanezumab early or if we're going to have to fail first a few other therapies. Obviously, there have been, you know, different position statements and things coming out saying you shouldn't have to fail first. But the reality is that's what insurance has been enforcing. And so, you know, it's I think it's sort of a the landscape is a to be determined. Many of the insurance companies will change their policies as of the turn of the year. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the beginning of 2026. And then, of course, there are many, many other trials that are ongoing and, you know, some of them are wrapping up. And so we're very hopeful that perhaps there will be more information coming out. The Fremanezumab episodic migraine trial was positive. The Fremanezumab chronic migraine trial was not, unfortunately, but essentially the Fremanezumab was not superior to placebo. So again, if I have a patient who has not had success with a number of other therapies who has chronic migraine, at this point, I'm still offering them Fremanezumab because I've seen it work, right? And so this is an example of the official and then the real world. But again, I think we're all very hopeful to see what happens with the trials that are coming out too.
That's great.
Well, this came up briefly a little bit earlier, Dr. Mspirka. What about these non-medicinal neuromodulation devices for acute treatment and or prevention of migraine in children and adolescents? And neuromodulation may be a very new concept mm-hmm. to some people.
Neuromodulation has been part of our treatment armamentarium for actually probably close to a decade now. But we have so much more access now than we did in the past. And so there are a number of devices. The majority of them have a little bit of evidence. The REN device, the Neurovio device, has actually quite a lot of evidence in children and adolescents. And both due to the lower upfront cost, as well as the added additional evidence we have from pediatrics, that is often our first go-to neuromodulation device. We have demos of most of the devices in our clinics, and so I find it very helpful to be able to show a child what the device looks like. And so, thanks to our nurses, we've got a number of different things. We'll do a little show and tell in clinic, because I think if you think about this thing, and you know, it seems so foreign, it's hard to think about should I do that or not, right? Should I purchase that device for my child or not? And so being able to feel it and see it and understand, okay, this is a pretty benign little thing, is often very helpful. There is insurance coverage for some devices, depending on, you know, which insurance company you have and which device and things like that. So that is unfortunately, I think, a major problem right now, because it means that I have to think about, should I offer this device to this child? And, you know, because I worry about walking in and saying, I want you to spend $100 to buy this device for the child, or a few hundred dollars to buy a device for a child. And if the family doesn't have the means to do that, again, then I'm taking something that could potentially be a positive and turning it into a negative. And then they feel guilty that they can't do that. And so I don't want to not offer it, but I also don't want to risk the family feeling like they have, you know, essentially that they're not able to provide something that I'm recommending. And so I really hope that in the future that we're able to continue to expand insurance coverage so that we can offer these devices regardless of, you know, essentially financial circumstances for the family.
And for those viewers who are interested in learning more about neuromodulation, we do have a specific interview on it
Perfect.
This year. What it is, how it works, different options, Good. Including the ages to which they are FDA cleared for this
yeah.
year.
Yeah, excellent.
Moving on, Dr. Mspirka, now to talk a little bit more about whole care, as we've touched on here while talking about acute and preventive options. There is a strong link between migraine and mental health, particularly anxiety and depression, not surprisingly. How do you address this in your clinical practice? What advice do you have for parents who are really interested in supporting, you know, their child's emotional well-being while managing migraine?
It's something that we just discuss very openly. So we have two psychologists actually on our team. And for we do essentially multidisciplinary intakes with our psychologist as well as actually our physical therapist for children who have not had benefit from a couple of medications, right? So second opinions, transferring within our division, et cetera. And so our psychologist is part of those visits. But even in every other of our intakes, essentially we are asking about mental health. We're asking about stressors. We're asking about anxiety because it is such a crucial part. And we do our best to really just normalize it. When we're thinking about how essentially anxiety and depression may be related to headache, I think it's also important to acknowledge sort of cause and effect, right? So there absolutely are circumstances where, for example, if a child's worried about their math test, that may bring on a migraine. But there's also at the same time a large component of anxiety around the migraine attack and how that's going to affect life. And so I have numerous times talked to colleagues who will say, oh, you know, the child's really depressed and that's why I've got a chronic headache. Well, pause. Were they depressed before they had a chronic headache, or are they feeling really depressed because they're not going to school and they're miserable and they're, you know, everything in their life has changed? And so I think it is really important that we think about anxiety and depression and that we treat anxiety and depression and we acknowledge it for what it is. But I also think it's important that we acknowledge the role that the migraine itself has in contributing to it, right? Both in the acute attack, because certainly the acute attack can affect your mood, but also in the overall realm of life.
So for caregivers whose children are not being seen and treated in a headache clinic, for instance, when should they consider seeking additional support from a psychologist or a therapist as really part of the migraine management plan that may focus on factors separate from and outside of that where they're seen?
So there's good evidence that cognitive behavioral therapy is very effective in migraine treatment. And again, that's not to treat the anxiety. That's a separate thing. It's great for anxiety as well, but to treat the migraine, even in children who don't have a diagnosis for anxiety or depression. And we absolutely, again, will offer that to many of our patients. There's an ongoing study looking at this essentially now in terms of if we're actually, the study is, it's being ran out of Cincinnati Children's. We're looking at cognitive behavioral therapy plus or minus use of amitriptyline. So do you even need a pill-based therapy? Perhaps CBT alone is sufficient. So I think that's an excellent option. And it's a very good non-medication option. If a family comes in and says, I don't want a med, we will talk about essentially the fact that there's really good evidence for CBT. Is that something that they're willing to consider? The problem, of course, is finding a psychologist who is able to do CBT, right? And so there are many, many, many children out there who might benefit from CBT, but not necessarily enough. And so there's, again, ongoing research to think about different ways to make it more accessible. You know, could a nurse do biofeedback? Could you use an app to do some of these things? So there's a lot of things essentially for the horizon.
So migraine can take a toll, not just on the child, but really on a whole family, certainly caregivers. How can parents and caregivers care for their own mental health while they are supporting a child with migraine or any chronic illness, really?
There's two pieces to this, I think. So one is the fact that the migraine feels so unpredictable, right? So, and it will often come out at a time when there's something going on, right? So it could be a happy stress, right? It can be a birthday party, and then suddenly your child has a migraine, and that's really frustrating. And so just, you know, trying to not overreact to that and kind of go with the flow, as you have to in life anyway, right? So trying to do your best to just take everything in stride as best as you can and, you know, acknowledge that was really frustrating, right? Don't pretend it wasn't frustrating. It was, but, you know, also try to keep going. But then I think the other piece of it is also just to make sure that the relationships in the family are not taken over by migraine, right? So you don't want to put all of your attention on your child who's in the middle of a migraine attack and not take care of the other kids. And again, you know, it sounds so harsh, but right, it's not intentional. Parents are trying to do their best, but you're only one person and you're trying to provide attention to everybody in the house, right? And I think we often put ourselves last. So trying to figure out how not to put yourself last all the time. But it's also okay to expect your child with migraine to do some chores, right? It's okay to expect them to fold the laundry. It's okay to ask them to empty the dishwasher. And I'm sorry you have a migraine, but we need to keep going, right? The same way that I think it's appropriate to expect them to go to school even when they're not feeling perfectly because it's the better thing for them in the long run, right? The more school they miss, the more stress they have from catching up and all of those things. It's also okay to expect them to do chores. And again, your family can figure that out, right? Is that do the chores on the days they feel better and ask a different child to do them on the days they don't feel well? But asking them to contribute to the family so that the other kids aren't feeling uncomfortable, you know, aren't feeling jealous about the difference in attention.
You mentioned school. So let's pivot and touch briefly, if we can, on education. School can bring some extra challenges for a child living with migraine. And one of our Migraine World Summit viewers, Anna, said she'd love help in better working with her son's school. Like many, she may not know about an organization called Migraine at School that actually works specifically on this advocacy with schools to support families with their children's educations. What do you see in your experience as the most crucial approaches or accommodations to help a student with migraine succeed academically?
So I'm glad you brought that organization up. They're excellent. So I think that it's important to really partner with your school. And in some ways, the most crucial thing for a child with a low frequency of attacks is to make sure they can go to the nurse and get their meds, right? And so understanding that the child's not faking, the child's not making it up, right? Just because the migraine comes on in the middle of the math test doesn't mean they're faking and they're trying to get out of the math test, right? It's just sometimes stress brings on a migraine that's not faking. So we're very clear of that with such when we have our 504 letters. But I think then also flexibility is key, right? So if the child is developing a migraine attack and they're supposed to do XYZ, right? Maybe they're supposed to take a test next period and they're really not going to do well on that test if they have brain fog in the middle of their attack. But perhaps by the time they take their meds, they're better at the end of the school day. They can take the migraine, they can take the test at the end of the school day or a different day, right? And so just flexibility. Say they make it through school and right, maybe they've had a migraine all week. Maybe it's an adolescent girl with her period. And they make it through the school day, then can we get permission not to do the homework in that afternoon, right? So can we essentially just get a little bit of slack here? So the child's pushing themselves really hard. Can we ask for just flexibility so that they can keep going, right? They're not losing ground and losing, essentially getting behind their peers, but they also maybe don't have to do absolutely everything all the time. And sometimes that's asking school. And honestly, sometimes it's giving the child permission because sometimes it's actually really the child who's driven to do everything and not ask for accommodations. And so trying to balance all of that.
Interesting. And you mentioned the 504 plan, which in the U.S. allows for accommodation in schools for kids with certain conditions. And those may be called different things and available in different ways in different countries. What is the best way for a caregiver to approach a school about pursuing some kind of accommodation through a plan like that or other?
Within the U.S., essentially, typically the public schools are using a formal 504 plan. Children who are in private school, it's often not a formal 504 plan, but it's usually a very similar process. And so essentially, it's just a matter of requesting to the school to say, my child has a medical condition, and migraine is now officially in the list of things that are acknowledged there, which is awesome. Thank you, advocates. That my child has a need to have a little bit of variation, right? To have a little bit of support, extra support and accommodation. And so whether that's the child's teacher, whether that's the guidance counselor, the school nurse, essentially just approaching them and saying, I need a little extra flexibility. I need my child to be guaranteed certain things because it will help them. It will level the playing field and help them to be able to perform the same as their peers is really important.
And I think it's so important for caregivers to understand that options like this exist. They're appropriate. And there's an organization like Migraine at School that can actually help them work through this to support their children in education. One thing to touch on here as we wrap up, Dr. Spurka, is really about the idea of empowering people of this age, right? Adolescence is such a key time for so many things, including identity and independence. How can both clinicians and parents help teens manage migraine without feeling like they're defined by it or limited by it, while also encouraging them to take ownership of it for their best health?
Absolutely. So, I think we actively try to coach teens to take more and more ownership of managing their migraine, right? I will often say to my patients, if you act like an adult, your parents will treat you like an adult, right? And so if you are able to think, to take your medications consistently, then they will let you take your medication, right? If you are forgetting it 4 out of 5 days, then they're going to nudge you and bug you and you're not going to be bugged, right? And so can you think about maybe, tools on your cell phone and things like that to remind you, I am both myself and certainly our, I would say it's standard in pediatrics that I talk to the child, right? I don't talk to the parent. Yes, the parent is part of the conversation, but I start with the child, right? And I want you to tell me what's going on, right? I got 5 messages from your mom in the past 6 months, but I want to hear from you what's been going on. And really invite them to tell their story. And the parents are there for backup, but that's training them for when they're an adult and they're essentially going to need to do this independently. So I think, as it both in our office visits, but also at home, the more that they can essentially advocate for themselves and do for themselves, that essentially that brings on that responsibility and that maturity.
So looking to the future, Dr. Spirko, what gives you the most hope for the next generation of kids growing up with migraine, both in terms of treatment or an understanding?
I think it's huge that we're acknowledging it, right? Like, it's so many parents will say, oh, I had this, but nobody paid attention or nobody diagnosed it, right? And now they're bringing their child in for care and that child is able to receive care. And it seems that, you know, if we are able to help that child early enough in the course, that we're going to change the trajectory and that we're going to actually help them, that perhaps maybe these teens in our office are not going to grow into, you know, having terrible migraine as adults. I'm not going to promise they're not going to have some, but, you know, many of them may get to the point where it's really a minimal problem for them. And so, you know, whether that's the actual medications we're using or whether that's just the whole approach that we're able to take and we're able to, you know, again, just bring this to public awareness, you know, I think it's a number of factors, but I think that there's a lot of reason for us to be hopeful.
Well, that is certainly a very encouraging perspective. Thank you. This topic is so important, right? Talking about this, understanding and being able to feel better equipped to help support children, adolescents, teens living with migraines. We're so appreciative of you being here with us, Dr. Spirko, to walk us through all of the important aspects related to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm grateful for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
And where can people who are interested in learning more about you or your work go?
We have a website for the Top Headache Program, and so we have a number of resources there. I would say there's, you know, it's you mentioned migrated schools. There's a lot of resources available to learn more about headache. Headache Relief Guide is another website I would mention. I said that's not me specifically, is it? But again, about information about migraine in children.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Dr. Spirko, thank you for joining us on the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you.